With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, and welcome to Going Off Track.
Hi.
Hey.
Glad to be here.
Yes. I'm Jonah, joined by Brad and Steven. Steven Grywalski, not to be confused with Steven Smith, who is...
not here right now.
Not here.
So he snuck in.
Yeah.
I got to fill the Steve quote.
Yeah,
we needed
a Steve. There's really bad traffic today, so unfortunately, Steven couldn't make it, but he'll be back soon. Today on the podcast, we have Frank Carter, who currently is the frontman of Frank Carter and the Rattlesnakes. You may also know him from his being the singer of Gallows and Pure Love. And Frank is also a very accomplished tattoo artist. And just to get out of the way, his latest album, Modern Ruin, came out in January on International Death Cult, and you can get it. Frank came by. I actually had never met Frank before, but, you know, Jim Carroll from Pure Love has been the podcast. He's a good friend. Played in United Nations briefly. And Frank's awesome.
This is a good one.
Yeah.
You're glad you're here.
Yeah.
Great band names, too.
Yeah, really good yeah. band names.
I mean, so good.
I agree. And he was here, and I feel like he got pretty deep, pretty personal. Frank was very open with us, and I think it ended up making this a really, really good interview. So, I think that's all we really need to say. What do you guys think?
I got nothing else. I got no color to add.
I just thought it was great.
Yeah.
Didn't really know of him and learned a lot.
Yeah.
Loved it.
Yeah, this is a great one, and let's just get straight into it. Let's check out this interview with Frank Carter.
It's going off track!
Jonah, I can't believe we all have mustaches right now.
It's great. Feels so good.
Do you trim yours back?
I trimmed mine today for the first time.
You have a mustache that would drive me crazy.
Yeah.
It's too far in the lip.
Yeah, I like it. I like it over the lip. If it's too short, then it makes my lips feel, I don't know.
Do you play with it though in inappropriate times?
No, but I noticed I was visiting my parents this week and my dad has the exact same mustache.
He does?
Yeah.
That's the first step.
I know. I was like, I think this mustache is cool. And then I went home and I was like, oh, I just look like my dad.
But that's just going to happen anyway, right? So is it okay to just acquiesce?
I'm desperately trying for that not to happen.
Yeah.
I feel like sometimes the older I get and I see these little things like peeking out.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? Like, fuck it. I should just stop fighting it.
Yeah.
Because like... No, it's just going to keep creeping.
No way, dude. I'm like shaving my ears, like the inside of my fucking nose.
I know.
Like, no chance, Dad.
That'll sneak up on you.
Yeah.
Are you living in the UK or the States right now?
I'm in the UK. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Been there for like, because I was here for almost 5 years, I think.
Okay.
And then when I left here, we were going to buy in London.
Okay.
And it just, for what we could get out in the country... it was an actual real house.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Not like a one-bed shoebox. So we were going to have a kid, so that was it, like straight out to the green fields of Hertfordshire.
Okay.
It's perfect, man. I love
and
it.
I actually know this place well because of a mutual friend, Ian Perkins, who plays in Gaslight. And it's funny you brought that up because it's a long-running joke with Ian that, like... everywhere in the world is basically a piece of shit to him, besides for like the 30-minute radius of that area, you know?
I think he's the only person there that feels
so
that way.
He's so pro Hertfordshire.
He really loves it, yeah.
But it is beautiful out there. I mean, like, we go to his parents' house who host dinner, and there's, like, literally, I mean, straw-thatched, like, roof, like, garden in the back, just so much green, and, like, it is beautiful.
It's weird for me, because it's, like, it's kind of the center of your universe, you know, where you grew up. And that's my hometown that we've moved back to. So it felt a bit weird going full circle ending up back there, but it's too good not to. We got, like, such a nice place, and it's two stops on the train, and you're in central London. So, but it's 30 miles away.
Right.
So it's, like, the kind of the dream, you know, like fresh air. There's a river at the end of my street, you know, my kid loves it. But then when they call, I can be at work in 25 minutes. So.
And you got family around there?
Yeah, like my whole family still lives there within like 10 minutes of my mum.
I did something
She's
really,
like in the center. You know?
Perfect.
I did something really embarrassing out there that people, you'll enjoy this. I was doing a story on Jimmy World. It's like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And I took the tube, whatever, they're staying somewhere, and they're like, oh, they changed hotels, they didn't have air conditioning. Take the train to the Gloucester stop. Mm-hmm. And I went back, and I took a train to Gloucester, England.
Oh, Jesus.
So, which is like, instead of going like two stops on the subway, it was like going to like...
Yeah, 2.5 hours
New
away.
Yeah, like another state.
Yeah.
And I got there, and I called, and they're like, we're across from McDonald's. I was like, I just see like a castle, and it took a really long time to get... And I was so late. But it was confusing. I'd never been to England before, and I was like, oh, that's a place I want.
Yeah.
So,
well, hey, why not? You know? It's a story.
Yeah, it's a good story. Now it's very embarrassing. It still is kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, that one's rough because I mean, if you were in like Japan or like the Czech Republic, it's somewhere with Z's or symbols. Yeah.
Where everyone doesn't
words.
Speak the same language as you.
But yeah, like you had a lot of opportunities
That's
to not
true.
Make that happen.
That is true. When you were in the States, were you living here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. I lived when I first moved here. I lived in Bushwick.
Okay.
And then I moved up to Greenpoint.
Okay.
Then I moved down to Carroll Gardens, and then I went home. So it's kind of did the natural progression of a Brooklynite, essentially.
Yeah,
that
you did the,
like,
really
the
new gentrification tour.
Yeah, like 1.5 years in each place. So just crushed down a lifetime into 5 years, and then went home.
But it seemed like you guys. I remember when you were doing Pure Love with Jim. I felt like. I was doing yoga with Jim in the morning, and I feel like every week he's like, I'm going to the UK for this Kerrang thing. I felt like you guys were over there so much, probably.
Yeah, it was like basically just a lot of mismanagement. We just made... at that point, I felt it was better the devil I knew.
Yeah.
It turns out it wasn't. Which happens a lot with managers and music and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, they had a very different idea of what the band was about than their band did.
Yeah.
And so, like, realistically, what we should have done is just jumped in a van and toured America while we were here relentlessly. And instead, we played one show in New York.
Yeah.
For the lifetime of that band.
At St. Vitus? Was that?
Yeah, I was there. It was a great show.
Yeah, it was fun.
And it was just so disappointing at the same time because it's just like we by that point, we'd started setting up things ourselves because we realized, like, they just weren't on board in the same way. And, it was too late. It was already too late, you know, kind of so much against us at that point that we just ended up sort of throwing it all in the mix and getting like enough money out of a label just to go and do some demos. So we got to record with Chris Goss, and that was basically all we wanted, was just like a weekend away with Chris. But we had to do it in New York. So he came to Brooklyn, and we got a few songs out of it. So it's a shame because, like, now I've got much better management.
Yeah.
Who actually, like, appreciate... like who I am as an artist, and they understand probably that band particularly better than any other band I've been in. But we're working on something new now. So it's, who knows what the future holds, you know?
Like,
I'm going to see Jim while I'm in town, and we'll chat, and hopefully there's more to come for that band down the line. But this time I'll be prepared. This time I'll have an actual plan, you know?
Definitely.
Was it one of those deals with the management where... they were kind of, you know, scaring you into, like, coming back to England? Like, if you don't do this interview, it all falls apart, like, that type of thing, or?
Yes and no. It was more that it was just all we had. So we were trying, and Jim and I knew, like, we're not scared of working hard. He's been in bands his whole life, so have I. So it was just a case of the only opportunities we had were there. Mm-hmm. And there was just a real block on America for us for whatever reason, which is crazy because we both lived here and he's taught here for such a long time.
Totally.
But it just didn't feel like we could step through the way that we needed to, which was just like, we should just, countless times we should have just got in the van and just driven and just played shows.
Yeah.
But we just, for whatever reason, it just didn't work out. And, you know, the deal that we got was like from a UK label. It basically, right, from the start of that band to the finish, it was just a catalogue of problems, a catalogue of errors. And the good stuff happened right at the beginning and right at the end, in that, like, we wrote some great songs. We got a really good deal. We actually got some money to live off for quite a while. But then we were working in the UK, so we were burning this money, just flying there all the time. And then right at the end, we got a second win and we started writing some really great music. But by that point, the damage was done. And that, I think, is when we opened our eyes and the reality of how mismanaged the situation had been was very clear. And it was at that point that we were just like, okay, sometimes you've got to know when to cut your losses, because otherwise, if we don't at this point, the only people that suffer are us. Mm. And this is going to, we're going to have debt in a few years that is insurmountable and we can't get out of. So
you want to, like, stay ahead of it?
Yeah, which is kind of what I've done in my career throughout. Like, I feel like I've always left the band before it's truly imploded, you know? Like, and not that I'm saying that that's, happened to anyone else. But, like, you know, I just...
Like, all my ex-girlfriends are lesbians now, man. Oh, all of them.
I just, you know, I've always tried to be one step ahead of the crash, you know?
Yeah.
And it's why I'm still doing this.
Definitely. You know? I mean, how did this kind of the solo stuff come about? Like, after the Pure Love thing, I mean, were you disillusioned for a while? Did you want to start something else up right away? Were you tattooing a lot?
I basically quit music. When Pure Love finished, that was what I said to Jim. I had a baby on the way. You know, we'd just moved home and I just said that I couldn't comprehend going out and touring and stuff, you know. So I just focused on tattooing. I was just, my whole heart was in providing some security and stability for my family, this like blossoming family that I was having. And that year, like, it started with getting pregnant, and it was like a really beautiful thing. And then my wife's father passed away like a month after that, which was just incredibly tragic and really traumatic. And then 2 weeks after that, we'd already scheduled our like last tour as Pure Love. So Jim had to fly over and we went and did that tour. And it was really emotional and it was like quite intense, you know, because there was a lot of support from people in the UK. And then a few months after that, like, I lost my job in the tattoo shop that I'd worked at for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And my wife lost hers too. And it was because, the reason they'd given was because I had spent too much time on tour. And I was like, dude, I'm here.
Wow, yeah.
I'm here now. Like, I get it, but I'm like, I'm grafting. I was working like 6 days a week. And I feel like there was maybe a resentment there that had been building that I hadn't seen. Mm. And then it just, when I was back full time, the fact that I was just there all the time, that resentment, it didn't go. It grew, you know. It was like, we can deal with you when you're kind of in and out.
Because you were at that shop all through Gallows and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it's like I would come off tour and I would just go and tattoo a bit and then I'd leave. And like, I think a lot of people, they don't like that. They just, you know, tattooers don't really like that.
There's a lot of territorialism too in like the tattoo world, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. But it's also like a, you know, I think ultimately, I can't speak for anyone, but I think like if they could do anything else, they probably would do what I do, because it's really fun and it's super easy and you know, you can work two jobs and it's great.
Like, yeah, yeah.
But a lot of tattooers just have tattooing, and a lot of tattooers are incredibly passionate about tattooing and they think that there's a definitive set way to do things.
Sure.
Which, like, I can appreciate and respect, but I disagree. Like, I think there's all kinds of different ways to do things, and I can only live life the way that I can live life.
Sure.
Know? So at the end of that year, I was like, wow, here I am, fucked. I've got nothing. I'm trying to work and I'm miserable because of it. And then my daughter was born, and it was like a truly, like, you know, sort of momentous occasion. It's like changes your whole life. And a week later, I said to my wife, like, I think I really need to start another band. Is that okay? And she was like so overwhelmingly supportive about it that she just that gave me the confidence and probably like the bravery to pursue it as fervently as I did, which was really like intense. Like I called Dean, the guitarist, in like December, and he was away, and he said, "Yeah, I'll be back in February, but like in the meantime, I'll send you some music." And he did, and I was like, this is exactly what I had in my head. Like, this is just, you know, it just sometimes it just works. And then with him and I, the minute we got in a room together, it was very clear that it was like when I met Jim. Like, we just had an understanding and a respect for each other. It's hard to find that, but when you find that in like-minded musicians, things can happen very quickly. So that band was always supposed to, Rattlesnakes was always supposed to be just like a bit of fun to blow off some steam. But like most things in life, like it didn't work out like that. And I'm really glad because, you know, I'm here in New York, like city I love. I'm getting to talk to people about my music, and it's building, it's growing now. So
Yeah. How have the shows been?
Intense.
The West Coast ones are pretty crazy.
Yeah, pretty intense. Like, I'm older now, and it's like I don't heal as quick as I used to, so I'm trying to be sensitive to that issue. But at the same time, like, we're unhinged punk rock band, like, so things happen. And yeah, we walked out on stage in LA, and it was kind of overwhelming, because it's the same feeling I got when we played Australia just before Christmas. Like, we did four shows there and they all sold out, that's just mental to me still. You know, I understand that I've been playing music for a long time, but to be on the opposite side of the world and playing, like, it's different from someone just listening to your record, you know. Mm-hmm. When you're there and you're playing and you're seeing how passionate people are about your music, and you understand then this has connected. Like,
does it feel different somehow because of your age and the things that have happened from A to B, then? Because the Gallows kind of had a quick and meteoric rise.
Yeah.
You know, I saw some of those early shows where people were going pretty fucking apeshit, especially in the UK.
Yeah.
Like, is something, what's different about what's happening now than what happened then to you?
It's much more considered from my perspective. Mm-hmm. And I have a huge level of respect for the situation that I'm in now, which is something I never had before. Anybody that knew me back then will understand that I was just like fairly nihilistic and quite an obnoxious, arrogant little prick. But also that was coming from like a place of just deep insecurity.
Sure.
You know, I wasn't equipped for the situation I was in. I felt like a bit of a fraud, and that was really difficult to deal with at 21, like having loads of money thrown at you. It's funny because I was talking to Dean yesterday, because we're out for 5 weeks, and that's like, feels like a bit of a long tour for me when you've got a kid.
Sure.
And then I was looking at my social security number, and I found like an email from like my manager in 2008, and it was like, yeah, you could, this is your schedule. And it was like the 1st of March till the 17th of September. And I was like, Jesus Christ. Like, that was, that I've scaled it down. That's like 5 months or something. Shit.
You didn't,
like,
even think twice about it then?
No, yeah, we just did it, and it was great. Yeah. You know, it was good fun. I mean, it wasn't. It was mental and a total mindfuck, and it was, the whole situation was insane. But like, in that time, we went to Europe twice, America twice, and toured the UK twice in like this, you know, insane. So it's, I just think nowadays, like, I've got a much greater appreciation of the situation. And so we're taking things much more carefully, and we're just much more respectful of everything, of all the opportunities, you know, because back then I just didn't give a shit.
It's great you have that chance again.
Exactly, man. Like, and it's important because, you know, back then I didn't understand what I had. And I think not many people do.
I mean, yeah, when you're can't young. Blame and yourself.
It just doesn't feel real.
And if it's any consolation, I remember meeting you guys for the first time. And, you know, you had a reputation, you know, just because of what you said and like the shows and stuff like that. I was like, all right, here we go.
Yeah.
And we can be like a chippy group sometimes, you know, if someone's like a dick. Yeah. So I was like, uh-oh. Like, and then I'm like, this guy's lovely. Like, I was like, this guy really seemed, I mean, he's so nice. I don't know. I didn't get that at all, if that's any consolation.
Good. Well, I appreciate that.
I remember when Gallows signed, it was sort of like all this talk of like, this is sort of the last band to sort of get like this big sort of deal with like this type of money, this kind of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. Did you get to like buy anything crazy that you still had? Like, did you buy like a Lamborghini or anything crazy? Because I feel like I would have instantly done that.
No, I was no, and the problem was again mismanagement.
Gotcha.
So what I did do is I learned a load of really expensive lessons about how you don't pool your publishing money together.
Gotcha.
To fund your band for 5 years, because that essentially just leaves everybody in debt to you, like to me. So there was like loads of, so no, I didn't get the Lamborghini, but other people did kind of. Yeah.
Wait, so how did you arrange that with publishing?
I don't know if it's right to get into it here. Do you
Fair
know
enough.
What I mean?
Yeah.
Just like, imagine like if you gave like a toddler, a publishing deal and a contract and like marker pens, and you just said, make the contract you want. And they scribble and took a shit on it, and then you signed it. That's pretty close. That's
good illustration.
Yeah. It was just fucking ridiculous. And but what I did do is, when I realized what was happening, we had like a little, me and my brother had a little bit of money left. Like, when I say a little bit, we had a lot. We had like 30 grand each left, which is that's a sizable amount of money to ever have had. We should have had like 10 times more than that.
Yeah.
But we didn't. We had this little amount. And so I called him and I said, like, explained the situation and said, like, we're fucked. Like, we've got no money. We need to do something with this now. Otherwise, because this is our lot. So we bought my mum's house for her. And that's what, that was the Lamborghini was, we just bought my mum's house for her. So she didn't have to worry about the mortgage anymore. And that, at that point, that was like the best, still is probably the best decision I've ever made with any money that I've ever had.
It must be a great feeling. So,
she's pretty pumped. Like,
yeah,
you know, it took a lot of stress off her, because at the point, like, her and my dad had split up a few years earlier, and it was just, she didn't really know how she was going to pay for it. So, it just made sense. But what it meant was that going forwards now, like, I receive my publishing money.
Yeah,
essentially.
Right.
So in the hope that one day I could buy a Lamborghini, do you know what I mean? Like, or another house or something.
Do you think in like retrospect, if like the first Gallows record was just, you know, successful and good rather than like a huge thing that really like threw you guys out there pretty fast, do you think, I mean, there's the potential that that's something that could still be happening? Was it really like the business that like broke up that band?
Yes and no. Like, I think it's a complicated situation, and there's so many different branches to it, you know? And the real difficulty is that the business side of it wasn't good. It wasn't handled particularly well, I don't think. And I've spoken to that about that with the people that were involved. But the people in the band, we were all like vastly different characters and probably like considerably too young to deal with the situation that we're in. Like most young bands, they kind of implode at some point, because you do some stupid shit as a kid, but everybody's looking at you and you've got loads of money, so you're doing the stupid shit in an expensive car that you can't, you know, like, it was just a situation that was just too out of control on so many levels. Like, the one good thing they did was just pack us off. They just sent us on tour relentlessly. So we had no real money we had no time to spend money. We were just constantly working, you know? But that meant that it established our band faster, well, globally, than any band was able to. But that was also like the money that we were supposed to have to live off, like, was just being thrown in. And stupid shit, you know, like, we were touring the entire US in a bus on our own, you know, not sharing. Like, I'm here now for 5 weeks and we're doing a bus show with a band because it's the only way we can make it work, and we're still losing money. Right. But that's just the reality of the situation. The drives on this tour that we've got coming up are insane. Like, played Tampa one day and then Kentucky the next, like... Cheers, guys. Thanks for that. So, but it's real. Like, it's, and this is the opportunity I've been given, so I'm going to make the most of it.
Definitely. You know? How do you sort of prioritize your time when you're writing for this project? Obviously, I'm sure you're still tattooing. You have a family. I mean, do you have to, like, set aside a certain amount of time every day to write? Or how do you, what's your kind of process like?
No, we wrote both these albums in 2015.
Okay.
So we've just been taking breaks since then from writing. We've got the writing coming up again soon. We've just started, like, Dean and I writing separately, and then we'll come together with a pool of stuff, and hopefully we'll have a few songs from that that will set the tone for the future. But we wrote everything in kind of from February to March, and recorded it in April for Blossom, and then released the record in August of the same year and started writing Modern Ruin in September.
Okay.
And then that was finished in a couple of months, and we recorded it in January of 2016, and then we just sat on it for a year because we knew we needed Blossom to go and do work, and we needed to go and tour Europe with that. So when people talk to me now about, like, how different the direction is of the record, you know, and what a progression they can see over 2 years, I'm like, nah, bruv, like, that was about 3 months, like, you know, so just wait until the next one. We're going operatic, you know.
Yeah,
tell me you've said that to like some snooty, like a real snooty interviewer who's like talking very reverentially about how they've explored your sound and totally figured it out, and you got to shoot him down.
Yeah, I mean,
that's happened.
I appreciate being the guy to let people down lightly. So it's not something I get to do very often, but yeah.
I appreciate that about you. I've always had a question. I remember one of the first times I saw you guys, and this is Gallows again, I'm sorry to go back, but I've always wondered about this. You were playing Reading and Leeds, I think maybe headlining Lockup Stage.
Yeah.
I think it might have been...
Could have been.
Maybe your first year even doing it, potentially. Yeah. And you had... a stage amp, you know, an empty cabinet.
Dummy cab.
Amp.
Yeah.
And I think we're intending to, like, light it on fire and crowd surf it.
Yeah.
Which I'm sitting on the side of the stage and I'm like, fuck yeah, Gallows, into this. Like, I'm worked up. And then I see you going at it with, like, a Bic.
Yeah.
And, dude, like, no lighter fluid, no nothing. And I'm like, what's homie expecting to happen here? Yeah. Like, that's not going to catch on fire. I've lit a lot of things on fire. Like,
you know what?
Everything, so what was going on soaked there? I've never been able to ask you.
Everything had been soaked.
Oh.
I poured, like, I came on stage, like, 5 minutes before we played with a bottle of lighter fluid and just soaked it all. And was just like, this is going to go up in the tent. This is going to be sick. Like, everyone's going to be pissed. And what I didn't realize had happened is, as soon as I'd walked off, a stage manager had watched me do that and had just taken a fire extinguisher and just gone... Just like, basically, so I'm up there and everything's still dripping and I'm like, yeah, this is going to need one click and just now it's going to go up.
Oh.
And I'm like, click,
and it was actually
click and nothing. And so then I just threw it in the crowd.
Yeah.
But then the best part was that it kind of caught on fire because someone texted me a picture of it in a bonfire in a campsite. Like,
oh,
thanks for the amp.
It makes a sick effigy bonfire.
I'm like, yeah, it caught light, but just 8 hours after it was supposed to. So,
yeah. I guess in retrospect, that stage manager was... Totally,
he was
doing
a really, really good thing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, essentially, that was a really dangerous
situation.
He may
have saved lives.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. But the whole reason was because of that, was because we were like a punk band.
Yeah.
In my mind. And I was just like, and I walked out and I didn't realize that they'd spent all this money on dummy caps. And I was like, this is bullshit. We're not Slayer. Like, what the fuck are these things? Like, this is, unless they work, why are they here? You know? And they were like, it looks cool. And I was like, it looks like shit. Like, who gives a fuck? They're not even mic'd up. Like, everyone can tell. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So then I just kicked the shit out of them, which was fun. Like, it was, you know, good fun throwing around some they're still heavy. They're still really heavy.
Yeah.
Still peepee.
I worked in a metal guy, you know? Metal tour, and every band had so many. I was like, why do you guys have them? They're like, because everyone else does. Like, we can't be the only band out there that doesn't have scrims. And like,
I wanted to be, that's the thing. I wanted to be the only band that didn't. And then I walked out and I was like, God damn it, you betrayed me. What the fuck? Yeah.
It's hard to keep punk rock in those environments.
Now I'm like, now I think about punk rock very differently in that, like, I think as long as I'm doing whatever the fuck I want, that's exactly punk rock. Like, so I wear a suit on stage and we have like white backline now, and you know, and on our next tour we're probably not going to have a backline at all because I want to build a stage set to play in.
Cool.
Because just fucking why not? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, I want to build, I want... you know, you go, you see Drake and you see Justin Bieber and you think, well, yeah, that's awesome. Like, because you're a pop star, you can have a fucking planet in the middle of your stage. But, like, I don't have a lot of money, but I can build shit. So why the fuck don't I just build some cool shit to play in? Like, we have a song called Neon Rust, which is about the apocalypse. Like, so that's, you know, December, our December tour in the UK, I'm just going to build, like, a wasteland. It's going to look like Terminator. Yeah, fuck
cool.
it. Why not? I'll just make it myself.
I love
it. Probably won't pass like health and safety standards, but I'll just make sure I've got the same stage manager.
Yeah,
like,
careful.
Don't worry, he's soaked everything. We're fine. We're all good.
Benny builds furniture. Maybe he could help you out.
Boom. Done.
Yeah, I'll hook you
Come
up.
Come over. Stay with Ian's parents.
You need a couple big cuts. We'll figure it out. Yeah, no problem.
He needs you to destroy the furniture. He needs you to destroy it.
Well, I mean, I think an understanding of building it helps you destroy it more functionally. Sure.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find that, like, you know, you're talking about writing with creativity, and I was wondering if your creativity with writing music and how you're feeling at the time with, like, your art and tattooing, if, like, the creativity comes in an overall wave that's, like, music and tattooing, or if it's, like, separate, exclusive from each other?
They kind of feed off each other, because I write a lot when I'm writing music, so I don't just write, like, a paragraph for a verse or whatever. I write like a whole story, and then like a really weird deranged story that has loads of characters in it, and some make it in and some don't, and that's always how I've written. And then when I get to the releasing of the lyrics, I just put the lyrics out and I burn the rest. And this time around, like, we used all of those extended lyrics in a book format of the album, so that we could basically just sell a new, you know, sell the album to people in different ways, because people don't buy music. So we wanted to make it them feel like they had like a really intimate portrayal of the band that helped them with their understanding and kind of got everyone up to speed. So when you kind of look at it like that, here I have all of these stories, and from that, then I'll probably do like paintings and stuff, just subconsciously, you know. Yeah. And then so like some of the characters in the story begin to like make their way onto paper, and then I'm like thinking, well, this would make a great tattoo, so let's go and tattoo it like that. Like everybody's got their like sort of vision of what like depression would be. Do you know what I mean? It's normally like the black dog. People call it the black dog or whatever. And mine has always been hyenas, like. Huh. Gibbering, laughing, like, and so I paint them all the time, and I've started tattooing them on people. So I think when you talk about it as waves, like, that's kind of what you do as an artist your whole life. You're just constantly riding waves, trying to keep afloat, and every now and again you get a good wave, and you just gotta like ride that wave as much as you can. And for me, I'm like dealing with just rolling waves of like, there's an art wave, like, cool, I'm going to swim over to that and see if I can hold on to that for a bit. And then, oh, here's a bigger music wave, so I'll go and swim that way. And so I've just been bouncing between and trying to catch the best wave of my life, like, constantly.
Cool.
I feel
it's exhausting.
It is. And I feel like you always have to remember, too, there's, like, another wave. Like, I always feel like, oh, I missed that wave. And then I'm like, okay, there's another one coming.
Exactly.
Like, don't obsess about this one.
Yeah, yeah. The sea is never, like, silent for long.
You
know, there's always something about
it. But it's scary when the sea is silent.
Yeah, and it's scary when the sea is rough, you know? Yeah. So it's like, you never really know, but you just got to remember, like, storms don't last. Like, they pass, you know, storm clouds pass. So you just... That's kind of, no matter how bad the situation gets, like, or how good the situation gets, I'm always aware to try and just enjoy whatever moment I'm in, no matter how bleak or how positive it is, because it will go. and then there'll be something new to come. So if you just try and make the best out of everything you've got going on, like, which this week has been a test, it's been pretty brutal for us. Like, we arrived in LA and, like, our tour manager quit, like, didn't even make it out day one. So, and when we got into it, we tried to get into it with him, but he's just ghosted all of us, so we haven't heard from him.
Whoa.
He's just done no work. So, like,
fuck.
None of the tour has advanced. So my friend has had to step in, and he's just, like, picking up the pieces, but he's calling me every day, like, what the fuck is going on? Like, who, did you get the baby that wrote your publishing contract to advance your tour? I'm like, yeah, I think I fucking did, you know?
So it's just shows booked, you know, and nothing is done.
Like, literally nothing is
That's
done.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's insane.
And no so, word.
Nothing. Just totally. No, no. And I called him and I said, look, because he basically just messaged us and said, like, I've got severe anxiety. It's with a heavy heart. I can't do the tour. And I was like, me too, but I'm fucking here. Like,
yeah.
I got a fucking 2-year-old. Like, get out here. Like, and so then, like, I give him a day, and then I called him and said, like, and just left a voicemail. Like, I get it. Like, I appreciate, and I don't want you to do the tour if you can't. Like, I understand it, but, like, at least help us find someone. You've got a responsibility, or at least send over what the work you have done, but nothing. Yeah. So it's just been. It's just like, of all the ways to start a tour, like, that's not the one you want. And it's the longest tour we've ever done. There's a lot of moving parts. We're hemorrhaging money, you know. So I'm still like, well, this is not going to stay. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
This will go, and this, like, we'll ride this wave. It's going to, I mean, the tour will be over in 5 weeks. So even if it's bad every day, it's 5 weeks, you know.
Well, sometimes it's better to get all the bullshit out in front, because then it just gets better from there.
Yeah, that's the hope, right?
Like, yeah.
So, I mean, I kind of feel
that
about my career.
You, on that.
You know, third time's the charm. Like, so we're trying to ride the wave. So,
is it hard for you to, like, give up control to, like, other people? Like, do you? Because I feel like sometimes with stuff like that, you're like, I want to do everything to make sure it gets done. Like, I feel like being in a band, you have to depend on so many other people, kind of, to do their jobs too.
Yeah, you do.
Is that difficult for you? Do you, because yeah. It seems like you're very self-sufficient with your writing and your art and that stuff.
Yeah, if it was just down to me, I think I'd be fine. But it's not. There's a lot of people involved, and there's a lot of people involved because I can't do it all on my own. Like, we just, right. No matter how much I'd want to. And also, like, I'm not the best person. I can fix this a problem, but there are other people that just have the instructions, so let them deal with that, you know. So for me, yeah, it's not been an easy task, but it's about finding the right. Luckily, we've got a pretty good team in place, and regardless of the fact that we've been let down by this guy who we did choose, you know, you learn your lessons, and next time we'll just make sure that we know who's coming, you know, like, we know who to expect. We'd never worked with this guy before. This is the first time, so. And it's because our guy back home his visa didn't come through. Mm. So he's been kind of like half advancing the tour from home now, going like, Jesus, I'm sorry. Like, and he's taking it all on his shoulders, but it's just nothing. It's not his fault. You know, it's no one's fault.
Yeah.
It's just a situation that has happened that we're dealing with the best way we can. And ultimately, like I was in SF the other day, and I was in the hotel, and I was like freaking out, and I've been having like a fucking 48 hour anxiety attack, you know, because as calm as I'm sitting here telling you guys, like, yeah, you just ride the wave, like, more often than not, like, I'm drowning in a sea of shit, you know, like, so, like, I'm there, and I'm
takes
like
a minute to get enlightened.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah. And I'm there, and I'm like in the room, and then I just remembered, like, oh, you're just gonna go and play a gig, it's all right, just go. And like, and I was like in the mirror, like, yeah, you love playing music, like, this is going to be fun. Go and play a gig. Have fun. I'll see you in a minute. You know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
So it's like, so you just go and you do your thing and you play. And it was super loud and super hot. And there was loads of people. It was like, we played Gilman.
Nice.
So it's like a pretty legendary venue,
yes.
You know. Definitely want to sort of tick off I've played a lot of legendary venues all over the world, and that was one I'd never got to. So,
see, it, I know I'm it, still it's still on my list.
We played it once. It was
never
awesome.
Got to do it.
Yeah,
it's a great room. You know,
you'll get there, Benny.
Yeah,
one day.
Yeah,
yeah.
Someone. I don't know. Brad, you feel like starting up a band again?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, good.
I played Gilman already, though.
Okay. Everyone else has played Gilman, Benny. But
fuck me.
You'll get there.
I quit. This sucks.
I've never played probably most of the places you played.
No.
No.
Me either.
Sucks.
You'll get there one day.
I definitely won't. I think the odds of you playing Gilman are much higher. Do you still listen to like a lot of heavier music, or what kind of stuff do you listen to kind of get inspired?
I listen to kind of exclusively Ennio Morricone at the minute.
Okay.
I don't know why. I just got in a... because I've been writing a load of like stories, like loads and like... I've got like four or five novels that I've been working on for like years, wow. for like 5 or 6 years that I'll like remember that they exist, and then I'll dive back in. And one in particular is like just this kind of epic that whenever I've had time, I've written a bit. And that is just the only thing that doesn't really trip me up. Like heavy music, as a singer, I like focus way too heavily on lyrics, and like I just listen, and that naturally just has a bad influence on whatever I'm writing, you know. So I try and find music. It was always, when I was living here, I was painting a lot, and the same thing happened. Like if I was listening to stuff that had too much lyrical content, I would sneak into the painting. So I just would listen to like Sleep like all the time, because it was just super heavy and droney, and at like 4 in the morning it's kind of what you need to just, it becomes meditative. And with like Ennio, the difference is that it takes, like each song is a bit of a journey, and it's like really, you know, it can be pretty, it can make any situation better. Like I was on the plane yesterday, and this like 75-year-old dude dropped like a glass of Coke and ice all over my lap, and I'm like sitting there listening to like A Fistful of Dollars, like with a smile on my face, just writing. Like, it's all good. Like an old man in my story just got stabbed to death, but it's all good. You know, like it's fine. So it was, yeah. It was like, that's kind of,
where does one start with Enya? I wouldn't even know where to begin.
You got to get the spaghetti western stuff. There's like three. It's amazing. It's funny you're listening to it on the plane, because that's where I listen to it. It's you put on the so headphones good. And you just, oh man, it's amazing shit. Wow,
sounds like a real journey. Joni, you've never done this? You're
never,
into all
no,
that
never.
Space
I'm
shit.
I'm going
no?
to now, for sure.
I'll ping you a playlist.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Enya, my Marconi
awesome.
Playlist.
Send that over.
I love it.
It's really good. I mean, but you know, it's like The Good, The Bad and The Ugly and Fistful of Dollars and stuff like that. But even songs from like Leon, like The Professional, Professional
Here. Yeah.
Like even stuff like that, like Chime, like there are songs on there that you would have heard countless times, but you just, it's different when you take it out of the, you know, the context of a film or whatever, and you're just in a plane, or you're in a van, or you're having like an anxiety attack, or you're like buzzing off life. Like it's just a really good soundtrack to living, I think, you know. And it's like super classic, but it can be applied really, really beautifully to whatever situation you're
in. And it's never been imitated like successfully. It's just the arrangements and the instrumentation. And you know, something really interesting about it is that that I found out long after I got really started getting into it, was that the director, Sergio Leone, who did all those films, he actually had Morricone write a lot of the music before they filmed it, and he played it on the set.
No way.
Yeah, so they were like listening to some of that music during some of those like bizarre scenes that they filmed. Do you ever get into those movies though? Like Good, the Bad and the Ugly?
Not so much.
They're pretty intense.
But likewise, he's done loads of stuff. He's stepped in and done loads of stuff with Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
So he's done loads of stuff on Kill Bill and Django Unchained, and you know, so, and it makes perfect sense, because I think both the two of them are just incredibly intense individuals that are very passionate about their art, and their art is, you know, writing in different ways. So that's what I've been listening to lately. Like, and then heavy music, I just love Trap Them. I just can't get enough of Trap Them.
Yeah.
Like, I think I listened to Damaged Prose like on repeat when I was writing like after Great Britain. Like I got pretty trapped in some stuff, and And I wrote like a whole record of music that never got released, and it's just incredibly violent and anarchic. And that was from listening to, just had Damaged Prose on repeat, pretty much. Like, just I was just writing, just scrawling shit, and but it never made it out. Probably for the best. Like, it's pretty violent. Oh gosh, just shrugged that one off, guys. I don't really know where to go.
But it's, like, it's funny hearing it because, like, you know, you speak so gently. It's almost like a Patrick Bateman, like American Psycho scenario. I'm thinking here. Like,
I hope I've got a bit of,
there's just this like
grip on my life
world of just, I mean, insanity going on some pages, and you present yourself but very warmly.
I feel like people have like.
And you might murder me after this, apparently.
Well, no. I think it's like Bret Easton Ellis more than Patrick Bateman.
Yeah. Oh, I see.
Like, I'm the puppet master. Hopefully not the puppet, you know.
Are people surprised, like, when they find out what you do? Because, like, I feel like I'll go to, like, my yoga studio and I'll be like, oh, you're in a band? I'm like, yeah, it's like a screamo band. And they're like, what?
What is that?
Like, it's like grindy, you know, like blast beats. And they're like, I have this kind of a mellow...
Yeah,
I don't know if you guys notice it, but I mean, do you feel like people kind of just meet you out or whatever, and like, oh, it's just Frank, whatever, and then they see like videos or whatever, and like, oh my god, what? Like, we did not see this coming.
Yeah, but it happens the other way as well. Like when I meet fans, like, because I tattoo a lot of people, and I mostly just tattoo fans of my band and whatever band that may be, and so they always come in and. The first thing is like, you're so nice. You're so nice in real life. And I sort of feel like they have this vision of me like in the grocery store, like smashing things up. Do you know what I mean? Like, where the fuck is the popcorn? Like, what the, you know, spitting in the cashier's face and stuff. And I'm like, I am a normal person. And then the second thing they say is like, you're a lot shorter in real life as well. And I'm like, yeah.
You know,
that tattoo just got more expensive. I don't know why.
Yeah, exactly.
So weird.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Whoa. So yeah.
I love that shit, man. Do you like, now that you're back home, is there a real difference between where you're living and like London as far as like the sort of surging like populism and Brexit type stuff? Is it a little more prevalent out in the country than it is in London?
Yeah, I mean, London is one of the most multicultural cities in the world, you know. Hertfordshire, not so much. Like, but that's kind of the way with most metropolises, do you know what I mean? Like, you go to the main city and everybody there is probably a little more understanding, a little more sympathetic of other people. Because that's naturally where the like-minded congregate.
Right.
You go out, the further you go, like, people are set in their ways and they know what they know, and a lot of it is just conditioning. They've been taught and told that is the way to act and behave, and so it's about, in my mind, it's about just trying to recondition, like, and all I can do is worry less about other people and just worry more about what I'm doing, and that involves like my kid, you know, just trying to be a better dad for her than I had, and I had a good dad, you know, like, but I, like, as I get older, I'm thinking like, okay, well, and he didn't, it's not that he didn't do things or he did do things, it's just I need to do things differently because, you know, like, I want her to feel this way about that and feel that way, you know. So I think we have, like, a huge responsibility to teach the generations that are coming, like, acceptance and equality, like, overall, because I think that's the one thing that is just still eating us up.
But do you get concerned about, and it's something that's prevalent to me right now, because I'm living in Jersey City, I have a small kid, just like you, and, you know, I want to go out to the country and I want to get more space. I mean, my two biggest hobbies and passions are like drums and woodworking, which just sucks in a city. See, like, both of them, you know, like, I need a garage like bad.
Hell yeah.
And but, like, you know, a lot of the places you start going out west around here is closer to where I grew up, and it's like some white trash shit and some like kind of ass backward shit, and I worry about, you know, as good a parents as we can be, the influence that people you go to school with and their parents and stuff are going to have.
That's
and
it,
if I leave the city, like, what's going to happen there? Like, do you have any fears about that?
Yeah, of course. Like, all the time. But I have those same fears, like, in the city, you know, like, with, you know, what ultimately, like, I am I'm entirely responsible for my daughter, and not at all now. She's her own, she's going to be her own person, you know, right. No matter, like, she's going to be influenced by the things that she's influenced by. And I'm just going to try and do my best and give her, teach her the right way, which is probably fucking wrong, because I don't know what the fuck I'm doing half the time, you know, like, sure. None of us, yeah, do, you, yeah, know. We're all just kids having kids. So you think at some point you feel like you're ready, and that's when you jump in and you have a kid, and then the minute they're born, you're like, I have, yeah, no fucking idea what I'm doing, yeah, and I don't forever now. Like, I'm just going to try and keep you alive.
Just stave off as much permanent damage as possible.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I feel you. Like, I get it. I mean, no matter where you go, though, you're going to have those fears and those influences, but, yeah, I have no idea what is the right way around that, but, yeah.
How do you sort of deal with anxiety and that kind of stuff? I mean, do you do meditation or any sort of, how do you sort of stay above, not above that stuff, but how do you not let it kind of overwhelm you?
Well, yeah, I meditate a fair bit, not as much as I should. I started doing yoga properly after I met Jim. He just, okay, was constantly on it.
And we did it. Yeah, we used to, yeah, go to the studio together.
Yeah, so he kind of brought that into my life.
How's his form, left it in there.
Jim's good. I mean, strong. He's really tall. Yeah,
he's
very good.
Tall guy. Yeah.
Yeah, he's a tall guy. So I think, but yeah, Jim was good. We haven't practiced. The studio we went to closed.
Oh, right.
It was, okay, in Williamsburg. Yeah. Go yoga. R.I.P. Yeah. But I do a lot of yoga still. Yeah, yeah. I feel like that definitely helps.
Yeah, it's just, I guess it's about balance. And for me, like, my mind is just constantly on work, and what it's the one thing I don't like about touring is that, like, there's so much time that cannot be spent working, but it's just frozen out of my day that nothing else can really happen.
Yeah,
and it drives me insane.
Yeah, I fucking hate
it. It's
too.
Like, it's really, yeah, really, and especially when you're like hands-on guy that, like, you want to woodwork or you want to play, yeah, drums or you want to write or whatever, like, it's difficult to make that work. So that's where Morricone is so good, because suddenly, like, a middle seat in the center of a plane on super turbulent ride, like, jammed in between, like, two people, you put that on and you're immediately transported to, like, Savannah. Do you know what I mean? And there's nothing. There's an eagle and there's blue skies and there's some blue mountains, and you're just like, okay, I can get in this. And so that I've done a lot of, and yeah, and but before I worked that out, it was medicine.
Yeah.
It was just like a doctor at home just prescribed me loads of pills, and I just started taking them, and I was like, oh, these have no side effects and are great. I just feel super fuzzy all the time. This is wicked. And then realized just all of the problems of that, and had to sort of wean myself off it quite sharply before it became just too much of a problem. So I was like straight edge from the age of 16 to 28. So it's a long time to be sober. It was all the way through Gallows. Like, and from that, probably it was for the best, because, like, there are a lot of situations there where just, like, everything was on hand, and I definitely avoided a lot of bad decisions that, with my kind of temperament and the sort of person I am, probably would have been a lot worse for me than other people. But also in doing that, there's a fair amount of arrested development that I'm kind of dealing with now. Mm. Like, as in, you know, you chuck a load of pills at me and I'm going to start taking them and they're going to feel great, and I'm like, this is easy now, touring's easy, right, you know, like, right, this, right, is sweet. And then, right, all of a sudden you're like, holy fuck, like, I can't function without this shit. So that's why, like, stuff like, and it's really nice to be able to find that same help in things that you care about, like Morricone, you know, like, he's the pills, so to speak, at the minute, like, until I get bored of that, and then I go, you know, back to trap them, probably. So, you know, so it's, but for now, it's like, it's the problem with, like, meditation and yoga and stuff like that is you need some space.
Yeah.
And you don't always have it on tour. Like, and I'm an insular person. So like what I've been trying to do is find a way to like bring everything as close to me as possible, like as in myself, like my thoughts, my space, like be able to live in this seat, you know, but with a vastly open mind, you know, and a big expanse to play around in. And so I've just been working on loads of different projects. And then when I get home, I'm going to try and buy, like, try and rent a big space, like a big warehouse, just to make whatever the fuck I need to make in there. And that'll be, that then will become, like, the anchor that I think has been lacking in my life for a little while. Because I've been getting by, I've been doing well, I've been painting and I've been writing music and... But I've never really had, like, we've got a studio in our back garden, but it's just not quite, it's like a little bit bigger than this, but narrower. And it's not, it's good, but like my wife is incredibly creative as well. She's a tattooer and an artist and a better singer than me. And so she's needs that space as well. So I think with everything that we've been talking about, like having a physical space that you can kind of, that can kind of be that, the, that physical representation of the madness in your mind, like where I can just walk from a writing desk to a tattoo station to a painting station to a music studio and do all of the things that I'm good at and that I love in life, like that will hopefully free me up. And just knowing that I have that space, I'm hoping is going to be like another weight that lifts a bit, you know.
That's cool.
Because mostly it's just like I worry about the future. I'm just a worrier. That's where my anxiety comes from, you know? Like, I worried about this tour before we got out here. I got out here and it all went to shit. And I was like, oh, I didn't... I'm still alive. I got my fucking Jamba Juice and I'm still alive. Like, yeah. It's... You know, like, it's never as bad as you think it's going to be.
But do you run into the opposite of something like that where it's like... I run into this problem where I was... like... Take the hypothetical and reverse it. Be like, oh yeah, I was really nervous about this tour. I was paranoid that something was going to go down. Yeah, then it went down. Yeah. Which means all my paranoia and all that shit was like totally legitimate. But, so the next time it happens, I'm probably fucking right.
Yeah.
Like, do you ever run into that?
No, thanks for that, Benny. I'm fucking terrified. Dude,
someone plays some Marconi.
That's almost like it happens twice then, because you worry about it.
Yeah,
and then it happens, and then it's like you have to go through it twice, or you worry about it and it doesn't happen, then you still sort of went through it.
I think for me, it's more that I worry that it's going to be like life changing. Like I worry that it's going to be like that. The situation will be so negative that I just can't get out of it, and I don't. When I'm stable, both feet on the ground, and I'm like in a relaxed environment, I'm able to tell myself like, that's not going to happen. Nothing is insurmountable. You know, you can even you get hit by a car, you're gonna move on. You know, like the worst that can happen is I die. And if I die, I fucking die. Like that's the end of it. You know, I won't be worried about it anymore. Everyone else will have to deal with it. It's not anything I wish for, but I'm just like, I just know that like, there's no mountain like too big really, you know, like, and if it's big then we'll just keep fucking climbing because that's all I've done for the past decade, you know, and I'm not tired yet, so...
All right. Thank you so much to Frank for coming by.
Fantastic.
It's really, really great. Check out Frank Hart and the Rattlesnakes' latest album, Modern Ruin. They're also touring a lot. So if they come to your town, they put on an amazing live show. And if you're in the UK, maybe Frank will tattoo you. I don't know. I never know.
If you're one of the lucky ones.
Yeah, definitely. You'd have to ask him. Don't ask us. We're just doing a podcast.
I'm sure he would.
Yeah, he probably would. Yeah, why not?
Mention us. Mention Going Off Track.
Yeah, mention Going Off Track. Do you want to get the Going Off Track logo tattooed on you and be the first person to do it?
Wait, no one's done that yet?
Yeah, believe it or not, no one has gotten a Going Off Track tattoo.
I always feel responsibility at saying things like that.
What do you mean?
You know, somebody's going to do it and we're going to change the logo.
I always worry I never got a band tattoo because I was always like, what if the band starts to suck? You know?
That's good thinking.
Unless it, you know? Or what, now it's like, what if the band reunites and they suck? And then like, isn't that band you have that tattoo of? And you're like, yeah, but when I liked, then I got the tattoo, they were like...
My mind has always worked that way, and that's why you'll notice there's no ink on this skin.
Steven, you have some tattoos, right?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. No band tattoos.
No band tattoos.
No band affiliation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even, what if, even boy bands?
That's the secret.
Yeah.
But what if that flying lion on your back starts to suck?
It's a good point,
You're
Brad.
You're screwed. I don't know. I've no.
All right, I'm gonna.
It's the end of the podcast.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in here. I'm gonna jump in here. If you love this interview and this witty banner at the end, please donate. You can donate a Venmo at Off Track. That'll go straight to Brad, our resident accountant.
You know, here's the deal. If you don't love it, you know what you get to do when you send money with Venmo. You get to comment on it, so you can say, "Hey, here's." Here's $10. Don't ever fucking talk like that again at the end of the podcast.
Send Brad some money via Venmo and just send the shit emoji. And be like, this is what I think of you
shit,
guys.
Sad face. Yeah. Crying.
Yeah. Yeah. Or the snowflake emoji for Brad.
Nice.
Thanks. So if you don't want to send Brad the snowflake emoji, you can
subscribe to us if you haven't already.
You can leave
it
us
means a lot.
Leave us a nice 5-star review and some comments on iTunes. There's a lot you can do to support this podcast. But yeah, thanks again to Pulse Music for having us. Thanks to Frank Carter for coming by and doing such an awesome job. And we'll be back next week with another episode. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.